Coming up next on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, resistance radio, and I like to say persistence radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we have an incredible show about what feeds us. We'll speak with Leslie Hubbard about her fascinating life as a former Buddhist nun who, in her 20s, in pursuit of deep spirituality and inner development, chose to live a monastic life with the renowned Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh in a hamlet in the French countryside. And we talk with Gregory Lewis, sous chef of the well-loved Maya restaurant, a popular staple in the Charlottesville restaurant landscape. Gregory is a chef who is known as much for his work ethic as for his skills in the back of the house. Today, he'll share some of his favorite recipes, and we'll get a peek into his world as he reveals his passion for life in the kitchen. Speaking of passion, I'm passionate about my friend Nancy. Are you there? Are you there?
I am here. I was going to say the same thing. I was going to say, speaking of the house, in terms of Gregory, speaking of the White House, Ellen, I think I have, very briefly and very simply, I think I have a solution to the shutdown.
What is it?
I have it. Tell me what you think of this. The government stops paying his cable bill. Come on.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
That's it. No TV for you.
Exactly. That's a great idea. I mean, if President and Congress are going to shut down the government and they're going to behave basically like bickering toddlers, then they also should not get paid as well, is what I think.
Or paid. How about that?
We're paid.
Time out.
Yeah.
Time out.
I mean, it's just been heartbreaking. Yeah, it's been heartbreaking. But you know how I really feel? I think Cardi B said it best, and unfortunately, I cannot utter a word of it on the radio, but it's how I feel, so I'm going to try. This S is really effing serious, bro. This S is crazy. Our country is in a hellhole now, all for an effing wall.
LED, bringing it to the Saturday morning. All right.
I mean, I'm no Ari Berman.
Asterisk or something, huh?
I'm no Ari Berman, but you know.
Jeez, thank goodness. No, you are you, and that's a whole nother show. But anyway,
right.
So he's talking today at 3, but more importantly, I'm gonna skip to. I'd rather segue to this. There's an event in D.C. and actually around the world, the Women's March. There's another Women's March today. There's even one in Lynchburg, actually. It's, you know, uniting the same motivation, standing united against him and his their policies. It starts around noon, around 11, sorry, at Lincoln Memorial. It ends up at the Lincoln Memorial. But in Lynchburg, around noon at the community market, there, you guys are going to have a march. Part of it's to endorse ratifying the Virginia
ERA
as the 38th state to ratify the ERA.
Yes.
So that's going on in your state. Yeah.
That was a great thing. The Virginia voted in. Also, wanted to mention to everyone, we're on iTunes now. And do you want to give a little social media
Yes,
thing?
Because we're not just on iTunes. Yes,
right.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. And here's the deal. If you feel like communicating with us, I have quite the question for you. Where do you think, of course, you can just follow with commenting, but where do you think Trump's going to wind up? Is he going to wind up behind the most beautiful concrete walls in a prison? Is he going to wind up in exile? Or where? And where? Or do you think he'll wind up being the assistant manager of a KFC just down the road from Mar-a-Lago? So where do you think he's going to be? Let us know and follow us.
Also, there's It's going to be hopefully the longest sentence that's ever associated with him. Hopefully, it will be behind bars. Okay. Anyway, speaking of why we're really here is because we have these amazing people. Our first guest is Leslie Hubbard. She's the Program Director for Student Learning and Initiatives at the University of Virginia's Contemplative Sciences Center. She received a Master's of Divinity from Harvard University and was ordained as a Buddhist nun, studying with Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh at his monastery in Bordeaux, France. She holds an MDiv in East Asian Religions from Harvard Divinity School. Welcome to the program, Leslie.
Thank you, Alan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so I have the pleasure of working with you at the Contemplative Sciences Center, and I know these days you're passionate about teaching and leading contemplative programming for students, and that you are heavily into training your body, perhaps as much as you've trained your mind, because in your personal life, you are quite an adventurer, an athlete, and an avid fitness junkie, as you try to help me on my path to become more in shape. So tell us, this quite a dichotomy, it seems. Tell us the story of how you came to be a Buddhist nun.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, if someone had told me in my 20s that I was going to be a Buddhist nun, like as a profession at some point, I would have just laughed and said, no way is that ever possible. I don't even know how you even start that path. Like, who has an idea like that? So I was, as you said, Ellen, I love training my body. I love going to CrossFit and weightlifting and running, anything kind of adventuresome and physical. And that all started with my interest in dance. So I was a professional dancer starting at the age of 10. And so training my body became just part of my life. And absolutely fascinated in terms of like what kind of level of awareness you can get from training the body and then what kind of like mental states you have to have. But there's no like mental training for dancers or pretty much athletes like at that time. It's way more popular now and athletics to like train your mind. But when I was exposed to meditation, my first reaction was like, I'm going to run. I'm not sitting still and just like doing nothing for, you know, like 10 minutes. That just seems like a waste of time. But so I did like went into like power yoga. I'm like, well, I got to get like something out of this. You know, like I got to like use all my muscles and, you know, get it, work up a sweat. And that was the closest thing I got to meditation. And then my mom went to Tibet when I was like 18, 19 years old because my stepfather passed away and she was just needing some space and seeking some answers. And she had been engaged in various religious practices and different traditions my whole entire life. So Buddhism became really like a huge part of her life at that point. So, you know, she's like giving me books. So she gave me the book, The Art of Happiness from the Dalai Lama. And also was telling me all about this like Western Buddhist nun that she traveled with during her time in Tibet and just like engrossed with this woman. So I started reading the Art of Happiness and was just enthralled by this idea of compassion and mind training. It's like, oh my God, this is like a whole nother area that like I've never thought about in terms of training. Like in my mind is like way more chaotic than my body. There's a lot of work I can do here, you know? So that like sparked my interest. And then she invited me to come to a New Year's Eve meditation retreat in California. And I was like, okay, that's the weirdest thing you've ever asked me to do, like New Year's Eve, but I'm down. I'm like all ready to try it. And I was all about the Tibetan Buddhist tradition because they have these things called prostrations. So you like meditate for hours and then you do these prostrations, which are kind of like burpees. Like it's very physical. So anyway, so I was the first time I went to this retreat, I was just like absolutely fascinated by the level at which you could train your mind and the level at which my mind was completely chaotic. And also the kinds of things that were addressed in the Buddhist meditation were things I thought about all the time, like strangely, like that our life is like so impermanent that we could die at any point during the day and like make the most of your life. All of these kinds of things that were just kind of like separate thoughts in my mind were in this very organized kind of system of contemplation. And I just fell in love with it. And after that retreat, I went home and I started a regular practice. And I was really trying to work on some of the habits that were inhibiting me from like being successful as a dancer, just a regular human being. Like I was incredibly critical of myself and others, like being in the performing arts world and whatnot. So I was trying to train my mind. And at some point I was like, okay, here's my little like mind training and here's my body training. How about I combine the two? So I thought, okay, how about I go to back to school? I was dancing professionally at the time. I'll go back to school and I'll finish my degree in dance, but I want to do it in choreography and performance so I can combine Buddhist themes with like dance, basically, and like start my own company. So I went to Europe. And I had a lot of free time in Europe because I couldn't work. So I was going to school and I experimented with all these different meditation styles, Tai Chi, Qigong, Buddhist meditation. I used to wake up like 3 hours early to do this long Buddhist meditation. And I went to retreats on the weekend. And I finally went to this really long 1 month retreat with this teacher called Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and it like rocked my world. It was like completely like we wake up at 3 a.m. and meditate, and like just like day after day, like chipping away at our minds, habits. And after that retreat, it was like I was determined that I wanted to do this full time. And so I went back to school. I almost wanted to drop out of school because in Buddhism, they're like, you have to change your mind today. Don't waste your time. And I'm like, I don't want to go to class anymore. I got to change my mind today. So I did finish because my mom made me. And then after that, I just went on this journey of, trying to figure out how can I do this full time? I want to offer this to the world. I want to offer this to myself. And I found this to be incredibly powerful transformation that was going on in myself. So I found this teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, and went to his monastery in France, stayed there for a month, and completely fell in love with it. But at the same time, I was like, this Zen stuff, this is too easy. It's got to be more complicated. So I was like, I got to go to the Himalayas. I have to go and like meditate in like really harsh conditions and like have these like tantric practices like given to me and like sit in a cave. And, you know, I'm like, all right, I'm going to try that. Because if I have a doubt in my mind and I ordain, then it's always going to be there. Like, mm-hmm. I always, you know, want to go to India. And so I'm like, just do it now. So I went to India. I went to Nepal. I went to Kathmandu and stayed in a monastery up in the mountains in basically a cave. And it was terrifying. And when I was there, the only practice that actually helped me deal with the stressors of that environment, which included like Nepalese militia, like walking by with like machine guns, like really wild animals that could kill me, and just like really harsh living conditions, like, you know, no hot water, no heat, food that was giving me allergies and like hives all over my body. And the only thing that helped me was Thich Nhat Hanh's practice of, it's very simple, like present moment, wonderful moment. And if you can transform a really awful moment into a wonderful moment and find contentment and happiness in that, then you're set. So it was just practicing that over and over again. And then understanding more about Thich Nhat Hanh's life and that he was in like extremely difficult conditions in the Vietnam War, in his love for the Vietnamese people and the American people, and coming and speaking out in front of Congress, asking for resolution for the Vietnam War. He became friends with Martin Luther King Jr. and was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. And I was like, okay, if this man has this much influence over the world with this simple thing, present moment, wonderful moment, and his teachings on compassion and equanimity, I have to go and learn from him. And like, he's getting older, so I need to take the opportunity now. So basically immediately left India and went and lived with him in France. And then after that, I basically was there for 6 months, and then I ordained as a Buddhist nun in his tradition, which starts as a noviceship. And then you're basically a novice, which means you have to take 10 vows, pretty serious vows of things like celibacy, being a vegetarian, not owning possessions, living in a community, not stealing, not lying. And if you can do those successfully in 4 years, then you become a fully ordained nun. And then after that, the next path is to become ordained as a Zen teacher, so that you have this superpower to go and teach Buddhist teachings to other people. So that was basically the story.
Have you, it's Nancy.
Hi, Nancy.
Have you, in all that time, have you also been a teacher as well of all of this?
Oh,
or just a student?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really interesting. When you ordain as a novice, the first thing that Thich Nhat Hanh tells you is you don't have to wait 8 years to become a teacher. Basically, by the way that you walk, by the way that you behave, by the way that you look at people, by the development of compassion and like kindness in your heart and your ability to practice deeply and be really present in whatever conditions is a teaching. You may never have to open your mouth and say anything that's like Buddhist related to anybody, but just your presence alone is a is a type of teaching. Just the way you behave and have a conversation with someone is a kind of teaching for other people. And so that's basically what I try to embody. And what's interesting is sometimes it happens when people who are actually ordained to teach forget kind of that basic thing. Like, you have to embody, you have to practice what you preach, basically. And they forget and they kind of get disconnected. So I saw that happen. So I was like, all right, I always want to be able to stay in the practice myself and embody whatever it is that if in the future I would teach. So I have always been an active member of the community in terms of teaching in that way, being a practitioner. And when I disrobed, which was, I was there for 8 years, when I disrobed, I started a community at Harvard to work with the students there and the faculty and staff at some points, and also just the local community members in Boston and Cambridge, to start up a small meditation group. And then extended that, and I worked with at Harvard Business School. I worked with students in the dorms. And this is like I don't know if y'all have been to Cambridge and Boston. It's an incredibly stressful environment. So like, they need these kinds of practices. And then now, basically, I teach for a living, full time at the Contemplative Sciences Center, and mostly work with students, but work with a variety of community members at UVA and beyond.
So what practices are you engaged with now? And, or actually, I'd like to just go back to the monastery, actually. What was it like there? And what did you do, not only day to day, but it's sort of serious business, it seems like. And you're such a fun-loving person. Not that you can't be a nun or a monk and be fun-loving. But, I mean, were you different then? And how did you engage with this whole Zen Buddhism?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So being in the monastery is kind of like going to college. Like, there's like different seasons, you know, you have like the fall semester, the spring semester, and then you got like internships in the summer. So this is very similar in the monastery. So let's take like a fall or springtime. Basically, you wake up at about 5 a.m. And of course, I'm an overachiever. So I was like, I'm waking up at 4. I'm doing yoga first. And then I'm going to go sit. So wake up super early, and then you do your meditation practice in silence and some sort of, I added exercise to the schedule when I had enough power to.
Of course you did.
Yeah. It became a mandatory thing that everyone had to do. So then we had to have an exercise time, and then we have a silent breakfast. Then everybody has a responsibility in the monastery, so like a work responsibility. So in what I call, quote unquote, my fun years, I had a very simple responsibility, which was like gardening, or I made tofu, which is actually fascinating. And and like I cut the grass, you know, like very simple, like you like think about a Zen monastery and like sweeping the floor. That's basically like what I did. When I got more advanced in terms of like understanding community dynamic and an organization, then my job then became like more organizational development, and I became the head of the U.S. tour, which means Tenan Han used to go to different cities in the U.S. and give big talks and retreats. So I used to manage that. So at that time in the morning, you do your work job. And then we all as a group practice walking meditation before lunch, and then our lunch is in silence. And in the afternoon, we engage in either our work again, or we do some studying of traditional Buddhist teachings. In the afternoon, we finish up with meditation. And then in the evening, it's kind of just a free time to just do what you want, basically.
Yeah. So we're talking with Leslie Hubbard. She is a Contemplative Sciences Center program developer for students. And she lived, as we've been hearing, in a Buddhist, what would you call it, monastery.
Yeah.
With famed Thich Nhat Hanh. We are going to be right back. We have this hard break coming up. We'll talk more with Leslie right after this. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Leslie Hubbard. So you were telling us about daily life in the your monastic life. Tell us more about that, what you did while you were there. Because you were there for 4 years as a novice, and then 4 more years, making 8 years. What do you call that, an ordained, full ordination?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I did 4 years in our center in France called Plum Village, and then 4 years in the New York Center called Blue Cliff Monastery. And But basically, like, half of our life is spent in the monastery focusing on cultivating our mind and cultivating our body to be fully present in activities. And you know, this is challenging because you have to we have to work with other people. So working, like, for example, in the kitchen is really hard. Being fully present and not getting in fights with your, like, fellow monks and nuns, and it happens, you know, and so you've got these practices. And then also we traveled quite frequently because Thich Nhat Hanh in the Buddhist world is pretty much a superstar. So we would, you know, get invited all of the time to different countries, and he would give big talks. Like in Hong Kong, for example, we rented out, like, the entire convention center. It's like 8,000 people. And so, you know, we had a talk that we all, you know, attended and whatnot. And then my first time ever traveling, we went to the Cannes Film Festival, which, like, for me was, like, thrilling, you know, because I was in the arts, you know, and I, like, that was, like, my dream. And then in the Cannes Film Festival, we meet Danny Glover, who apparently is a Buddhist, and Thich Nhat Hanh became friends with Danny Glover instantly, and we got invited, you know, to go see his film, like, walking down the red carpet with Thich Nhat Hanh mindfully. And then that was, like, the first opportunity to that I traveled with him, which is traveling with a Zen master is just really interesting. Like, he has blogs and stuff about, like traveling in the airport. You know, like, usually when you go to the airport, you, like, rush through it and you're just like, I hate this, you know, but he's like, every step has to be mindful. We get there, like, 3 hours early, so you can, like, walk mindfully to the bathroom and, like, walk mindfully through security, and you're like, all right, come on, let's go. Like, but like, this is the kind of, like, thing. It's like you take everything in your daily life and you transform it into this practice center. And traveling's, like, a great example of perfect opportunity to practice being present and not getting irritated and just staying focused.
What about all that prompted you? Because it sounds like you were doing just about, like, ping-ponging around to all these amazing places. So I'm just wondering why. When did you know it was time to leave, or why was it time to leave?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it was about 8 years. So I was about to be ordained as this Zen teacher, and I felt that the whole time I was there, while I was, like, deeply engaged in these practices, I had absolutely no time to study, like, the traditional languages of Buddhism, like, this would be Chinese or Sanskrit. I didn't have time to read the, like, original texts. I heard, of course, commentaries and, like, amazing translations from Thich Nhat Hanh, but I had this craving to, like, learn more about these kind of, like, root texts and practices so that I could be a better teacher and have more flexibility in the way that I translated things. And also, I was honestly burnt out. So traveling all around the world and then having a lot of responsibility at a young age and not a lot of power, honestly, because there's a hierarchy in Buddhism. I felt a little bit discouraged after a while and needed a break. And there were some, like, political things that were going on in the monastery. We expanded really fast, and we didn't have enough, like, powerful leaders to be in all these different centers. So you can imagine it creates a little bit of chaos and a little bit of uncertainty, and a little bit of, like, breaking the rules and nobody, like, being accountable for each other. So I felt it was a little bit unstable. And I had this just desire to change my environment so that I could train more in those classical teachings and be more experimental in terms of how I apply Buddhist teachings in different parts of society. So when I found out that there were graduate programs in Buddhism, I just, like, got so excited. I was like, oh my God, there's, like, tons of them, and they, like, pay you to go there. I was like, this is great. So I applied to graduate school and felt like this is the time that I need to leave.
Leslie, how many languages do you know fluently?
Oh,
enough,
God.
Anyway.
Well, my English friends say I can't speak English very well, like my British friends.
Shut up.
So, well, I studied Chinese painfully at Harvard. So I can't speak Chinese, which is actually very fun to, like, start speaking Chinese to, like, people who, like a white girl speaking Chinese. Like, they don't expect it. So I can speak Chinese. I can speak a little bit of Vietnamese because I had to in the monastery, and a little bit of French.
I'm surprised there's not more, only because, exactly, I mean, all the communication you're doing in all these, as you mentioned, the kitchen, just the fact you need to communicate, you know, I'm surprised it's only three, but it's still two more than I know, so I'm not one to talk. And then I'm not sure where this fits in your timeline, but the Wake Up Movement, was that after you left the monastery? Is that part of it?
Yeah, so the Wake Up Movement was while I was in the monastery and after. So that's a really beautiful movement for young adults, so about 18 to about 34. And it is to basically like empower young people to take these teachings of being present, of being compassionate into their daily lives and become more like, I guess, like activists in their different areas. And it is all led by young adults. So there's no like I guess you could say elder who's like leading the different groups in different parts of the world. And they do a lot of cool stuff. Like they do large group meditations in San Francisco and New York. And the biggest group is in England. And they work side by side with Thich Nhat Hanh, although his health isn't so well right now. But in the past, worked side by side with Thich Nhat Hanh to start some really cool movements that were appropriate for the younger generation.
So, what did you learn? This is a big question. Just looking back a little bit, what have you learned from this whole experience? We went through quite a lot.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. No. So, what have I learned from this whole experience? Well, that you. Practice of anything is a minute by minute experience in practice. Like you like, for example, like you can't, like I can't say like, oh, I practiced 8 years as a monk or a nun and then I'm done and set for life, like my brain changed. But I have to take that every single moment of my day and utilize that practice and meet the moment where it is. And it's very humbling, to be able to apply that, to be able to be present and open-minded and compassionate, with each step you take, with each breath you take is always going to be extremely humbling, force in my life. And always that I'm constantly learning, like, you could say that, yes, I practiced 8 years with Thich Nhat Hanh, who's just an incredible human being who's written amazing books, has incredible insights, and that is such a gift that I have that stored in my mind and body. But I learn from everybody in my life every day. There are all these like little mini Zen masters, even the people that are challenging for me. It's like, all right, little mini Zen master in disguise helping me to be more patient.
Mm-hmm. So, I already presume you have done this, but how have you combined this knowledge and experience into your role as a director right now at the Contemplative Sciences Center?
So I love working at UVA and a college campus in general because it's like a mini society. You have, like the Center for Politics, you have the business school, you have people in the arts and humanities. So there's just a lot of diversity. And being with Thich Nhat Hanh and traveling around to different groups, like the artists, the politicians, and whatnot, was a good training to start thinking about, okay, so how can we apply some of these like basic practices to help people be more centered and calm and compassionate in these different ways? So how can you speak the language of these different communities work with them to meet their own goals? So that flexibility definitely stemmed from my work with Thich Nhat Hanh, and that we also have to practice within our own organization as well. And that is an ongoing practice, to work together in harmony, to keep developing listening skills, to be present and resolve conflicts and whatnot. So that is always going to be a practice no matter where we go. And that helps also in like staff trainings and faculty trainings as well to create those harmonious conditions in the workplace, because we spend most of our life in the workplace and we would like to have that harmony when we wake up in the morning and that motivation to go to work, so that we can like keep going in that North Star direction of our passion collectively.
I know you teach.
Go ahead, Ellen.
Oh, you go ahead, Nancy.
Oh, all righty.
So kind.
Leslie, do you find that students are receptive to this? I mean, do they want this too, or is it also a process for them to realize how valuable it is?
Yeah. So my experience working with students is that we can't meet the demand that, you know, like they want more classes in this. They want to learn more information. They're also deeply engaged. So I recently had the privilege of teaching a class called The Art and Science of Human Flourishing, where contemplative practices are deeply a part of that class. And it's like with 60 students, and they're all first year students and a combination of student athletes and artists and scientists. And they all in like the course evaluations were like, this is one of my favorite classes. Like it was so great because I could apply it to my daily life. And these are kinds of teachings that we want to help the next generation, you know, at least like have is their toolkit as they go through college and then beyond, because it's not being addressed in our education system. Like, how do you resolve a conflict with your roommate? Like, how do you listen deeply to your partner when, you know, you're both fired up and angry? You know, these are really important things. They completely can derail our life if we don't address them. So I have a lot of students just like in love with these kind of practices.
Can you give us an example of a tool that you use that the kids like?
Oh, sure. Well, they really need to learn to relax. So the a lot of stories about stressed out students. So the favorite practice of students is called body scan. So it can be done anywhere in life, but mostly when we're, you know, going to bed or just need, you know, like a quiet space to just stop and breathe. And they basically go through the crown of your head down to the soles of your feet, and you just bring awareness to that those different parts of the body, recognize if you're holding tension, and then release the tension, and you do so with the breath. And it's a really nice practice because the body's so tangible. And we're storing tension all day long. We don't even realize it, and it starts to accumulate, and then we get like tension angry, and we don't even know why we're upset. You know, like it's like our shoulders are sending signals to us, our lower back, and it's causing us to have, you know, like just like this kind of hangry attitude in our life. So being able to recognize those signs from the body and being able to relax helps students in so many different ways. It's just like a really nice entry level practice. And it can be done anywhere. It can be done standing in line in the grocery store. Like, how many times do you sit in line? You're like looking at the person in front of you like, oh my God, why did you buy all that stuff? You know, like I hate my life right now. I'm like stopping. It's like this is preventing me from being happy, you know? But like standing in line and be like, oh my God, I'm getting worked up. My shoulders are all tense. My face is all tense. How about I just do a little body scan here? You know, like make the moment a lot better than I was, you know, experiencing it before. So That's a practice everybody loves.
Oh, obviously the flourishing is happening instantly. I'm glad. It's great that the students are seeing the value of it. That's why I was wondering if they had to be convinced. Obviously they don't need much convincing. It's
valuable. Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I think flourishing is a big concept at the Contemplative Sciences Center, and so is there something, not necessarily about flourishing, about anything you want to leave us with? Because unfortunately, at least for me, we need to move on.
Yeah.
But do you want to leave us with anything about
that? Yeah, absolutely. So in Tan and Han's tradition, we call these little sayings mantras. But they're just like kind of like phrases that you can just remember, carry with you in your pocket. And, you know, present moment, wonderful moment. It has been incredibly transformative from the time I first read it until this very moment right now. And really, like, we have a choice, no matter where we are in our environment, to create the conditions for happiness, even though it might take a lot of creativity. But just when we go throughout our day, remembering that we have the option to come back to our bodies, come back to our minds, and recognize that what we have in this moment is everything that we need. And we just have to be open enough to be able to see that.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Leslie Hubbard. We've been following her fascinating life as a Buddhist nun, and now she helps students at the University of Virginia through the Contemplative Sciences Center discover mindfulness and balance in their own lives. Thank you so much for being here, Leslie.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so humbled that you asked me to come.
Oh, yeah. It was great. You'll come back and tell us about your next adventures that you're into?
Okay, great. Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Hey, Nance, what do you think about a news of note? I think we're running a little bit short on time.
I agree. I think we should be in the moment, and particularly in lieu of the clock. Yes, I totally agree.
So astute. Yes, let's be in the moment. So we're gonna go right to our next guest, who I'm really excited is here with us today, Gregory Lewis. He's a sous chef of Charlottesville Maya Restaurant. Again, he is known for his work ethic as much as his skills in the back of the house. Excuse me. today we're going to get a peek into his world as he reveals his passion for life in the kitchen. And I don't know if he did bring a couple of recipes, but he did. He's got them. Well, of course he's got them right in his head. He's signaling that. So welcome to the show, Gregory Lewis.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yes. So tell us about your first experiences with food and what you remember. Do you have any nostalgic memories of that? Did that help create or boost you into this life as a chef? Perhaps with your family?
Well, you know, I grew up with a single parent who I saw, you know, struggle a little bit getting food on the table some nights. You know, so with that, I was instantly drawn to food. Just knowing that it's a huge connection for people. Everyone has to eat.
Yes.
It brings people together in so many different ways. I just fell in love with it. And, you know, my first real memory of food was actually my first job at 14 at Martha's Cafe. The owner of that place really reached out to me and kind of showed me the basics of, like, what it takes to be a professional. I let some of that stuff slide, you know, in my younger days, but eventually, you know, I always came back to it. It's a true calling and a passion for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. Were you trained in a kitchen, or did you actually, you know, go to school? How were you trained, Gregory?
Hard knocks. Really, just working in the kitchen. You know, I was very fortunate that a lot of chefs actually start at the very bottom, you know, washing dishes and working their way up. I got very fortunate and was able to get right on the line with very little experience under my belt, and just really grew from there. And having an opportunity to work with and around some great people really showed me a lot of, you know, a lot of new skills, a lot of new tricks, a lot of techniques. And really, you know, opened my eyes to a career in cooking. Rather than just being a job.
What are some of the techniques that you like to use that you think are really that you're really proud of?
My butchering skills.
Butchering.
Yes. Yeah. Very fortunate, Maya, that we get to work with so many great purveyors with fresh produce. I get so many orders in weekly that need to be broken down. I feel as though I'm one of the best at getting it done and getting it done efficiently.
When you say broken down, you mean the actual?
Yeah, you know, butchering. So yeah, the actual butchering, the actual, like, you know, sectioning and portioning out of chickens and pork and, you know, just
whatnot.
A multitude. Yeah, the multitude of things that we actually get. Very, very few restaurants I feel that I've been in actually get a chance to work with some of the exotic animals such as rabbit and, you know, duck on a regular basis. We're very fortunate, Maya, that we have those connections.
So we're going to go to a hard break, and when we come back, we're going to be back with more from Gregory Lewis. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with sous chef of Maya Restaurant, Gregory Lewis. So, just piggybacking on the topic that we were talking about before, with
piggybacking, how interesting, Ellen. The guy's a butcher slash sous chef.
Look at me. I was just going to say, what is it like? And actually, Leslie helped with this question because she's here too. What is it like? I know that sometimes it's difficult to get along with your coworkers, and the kitchen is a very intense place. I've seen on a lot of cooking shows. So how do you bring that all together? Because you're in charge.
It's not always easy. you really try your best, or at least I really try my best to start out on a good foot. Greet everyone as they come in the door. Ask how they're doing and actually kind of care about how they're really doing rather than just saying it. Throughout the day, just trying to stay positive. Every kitchen has their hard moments of, you know, hard to stay positive moments. It's not easy. Usually a challenge. But get it done somehow. It's in really how you approach your situation. I look at everything as a have to get it done situation. So I really focus on, like, hey, you know, if you're working hard, then I have nothing but great things to say. You know, it's, we all have those times of like we're not as busy as we should be. And so, yeah, people get complacent. And, you know, there's in a kitchen, there's always something to do.
And how do you practice that in yourself?
I just focus a lot on what needs to be done.
I know you get up early. Is that true?
Yeah, yeah. I'm a no alarm clock early riser.
You get out without the alarm clock?
Every day.
At the same time?
Around about the same time, 5:30, 6 o'clock. Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I can't help myself. There's a drive that's there. I tell my friends I'm like a diesel engine, is that, you know, it takes a while to get the glow plugs going, but once the engine's running, it runs all day. So I pride myself on that. I pride myself on, being an extremely hard worker, not just for myself, but, you know, for the rest of the crew. And definitely for the customers. Working in a kitchen is inviting, but it's also like you're having a huge party every night, and you never know how many people are coming. So you want to satisfy everyone that you can. And I think we do a great job at that at Maya.
And Gregory, did you wind up there because of your mindset about food, or did your mindset now sort of become part of the Maya menu?
I think it's a little 50-50. I got really lucky in getting a job at Maya. I was looking for a job as I recently moved back into town from Lexington, and got very fortunate that, you know, I got brought on in a position I wasn't exactly comfortable with. But I kind of stuck it out and worked my way up. And as I worked my way up, more doors opened and I had more opportunities to show my skills and to learn more skills. And, the more you show, then somehow, like, the more you learn. So I got very fortunate in that. Just as a side note, I've actually been in that building 11 years.
Wow.
Under two different restaurants. So that place really is kind of like home to me.
That's great. And I did tease about a recipe. What are you going to share with us today?
I have a couple recipes that are kind of ingrained. One is a bolognese, very classic Italian. It's super simple. I go to restaurants and I know, like, I can tell if it's been confit or not, or if it's just been made.
You're going to have to explain what these terms mean. All right, for everyone who does not watch Chopped.
So confit for me is cooked in a layer of fat of some sort, butter, duck fat, olive oil or something. So for my bolognese, I usually take an onion, a carrot, fine dice, two cloves of garlic, shaved, sweat that, 1 pound of ground beef, 1 pound of pork, can of San Marzano tomatoes, which I personally...
Do you really think those are better? That's my question.
Well, it's all in the eye of the holder, isn't it? I mean, I'm a fan. Others
aren't.
That's
fair. That's good. I trust you.
But I like them whole, so I can actually crush them up with my own hands.
And isn't it true that I feel like whole tomatoes in a can, they're probably going to be a better quality because they can't hide it by chopping it up.
Exactly. Okay. Look at you, actually. That was well done.
Oh, thank you.
So you sweat all your vegetables, you brown all your meat, and then I make a little sachet of rosemary, sage, and thyme.
A sachet?
Yeah, sachet. It's just a little bundle you put together, tied up. And with that, I add 1 pound of butter.
A pound?
A pound. 1 pound of butter.
Wait, how many sticks is that?
Well, it's 4 sticks to a pound. But 1 pound of butter goes a long way.
Four sticks? I'm sorry.
Four? Okay. Four, yeah. Okay. So what that does is, as that cooks down, it gets incorporated. Once it cools and it contracts itself, becomes a really tight mass of meat and tomato and deliciousness.
Yes.
And as you reheat it, it expands and just blows up. So it's just one of my favorites.
Yeah, that sounds delicious. And so bolognese is like usually on a pot. It's always on a pasta of some kind. Is there a certain kind of pasta that's best with that?
I prefer tagliatelle.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Are those?
Are you? Yeah, go ahead. Gregory, do you have a spot in the kitchen for Ellen? She's obviously going to be shattering the cold. So I want to say goodbye to my co-host. Have an enjoyable life.
I'm sorry I had to leave the show to you, Nancy, because I'm working in the Maya kitchen.
She's auditioning, Gregory.
Well, we could take it. I will take any pair of great hands I can. Trust me.
Okay. I was just wondering if a layperson can get in here. How important is it to you to use local ingredients, specific, you know, Charlottesville even? How important is that to anything that you present, you know, night after night?
I think it's hugely important. I mean, for Charlottesville, we have such a great market, and our surrounding counties produce such, you know, outstanding produce, and you know, I have farmers who are raising great animals, and to have access to that. You know, in Charlottesville, and you know, in other larger cities, that, you know, such as Richmond, is a huge benefit. I think it connects people with their area. You know, it's, I think that's a big part of eating, is being connected, not only to your food but also to your community.
Are you the one making the specials on the specials board, or at least contributing to them? That sort of thing.
Yes, my contribution is the knife work. I have a great partner who. Has a great mind for specials, and he's very creative, and he creates it, and I'm just the one who executes it and puts it together. So yeah, it's a shared obligation, really. You know, everything in the kitchen is, it's ours, it's not mine, it's not his, it's, you know, it's a community.
Could I ask you for one more recipe?
Sure. I make this at work sometimes. It's one of our staff meals sometimes. I make spetzel. Which is, you know, really easy. It's just and extremely cheap. 1 pound, 1 pound of AP flour.
Tell us what it is first.
Oh, spetzel. So spetzel is like a mixture between. It's essentially chopped up German, chopped up German pasta. Essentially, I mean, it's pasta in a rice form. I love it. I think it's super easy. Yeah, 1 cup of flour, 2 eggs, 1/4 cup of milk, and that's it. Just mix it, let sit, has to rest a little bit. And then it's really funny because I have a spetzel maker at home, and I bring it to work occasionally, but when I forget it, I just use a colander. So you pour it into a colander over boiling water, you know, just scraping it back and forth so it breaks off, and as it comes to the top, you scoop it off, and... You can cook that then with brown butter, salt and pepper. Yeah, really easy.
Interesting. So is the colander creating the little rice like?
Exactly. Yeah. So as you pour it in and you're kind of forcing it through. So in the emotions of going back and forth, you're essentially breaking it up.
Interesting.
I don't think I have anyway. Gregory, what is the cuisine at Maya, for goodness sake?
It is classic comfort food. You know, we do a little bit of everything. It's classic Southern. It's extremely invitable. You know, it's non-presumptuous, let's say. It's just real food. We do everything from ribs to trout to, you know, occasionally we'll do duck and rabbit. A little bit of everything.
I do love the trout there. I recall.
Yes, I remember you telling me that.
Yeah, and where is that from?
It's from Rag Mountain trout up in I think it's Madison. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, have any family members far and wide have shown up surprising you or invited? Have you yet, you know, had family members serve?
I haven't, but I invite everyone. I tell everyone that I know, please come see me at Maya and let me feed you. It's just one of those things. It's such a great community at Maya that I just want people to come in and be part of a family. You know, it's a very family focused atmosphere that we work in, and the more people that can be a part of that, I'm all about it.
So, what is a favorite protein of yours? I'm doing one, Ellen. I'm going into your world. What's a favorite protein of yours? Or what's a favorite spice or a combo? What is a favorite right now for you?
Wow. Really, it's always pork. I mean, it's Southern. I mean, it's classic. It's versatile. I mean, you know, there's so much you can do with it. From, you know, some people don't like the term from the rooter to the pooter. You know, but there's, you know, a lot of versatility in using pig. So it's one of my favorites and has been for a long time.
Cool. So just thanks for being here. Leave us with one kitchen tip, if you will.
Wow, one kitchen tip.
Things that people maybe make mistakes in, or like a pet peeve or...
Patience and practice. Knife skills are the foundation of getting things done. So practice knife skills. You know, cut things the same every time. Know how to cut it. Know why you're cutting it that way. And, I mean, that'll help you tremendously down the road. I mean, just having proper knife skills.
Thank you. Patience and practice. That just totally works in with our theme today of present moment, wonderful moment, mindfulness. Thank you so much, Gregory Lewis.
Thank you, guys.
And thank you, Leslie Hubbard.
Thank you.
Yes, it was great to talk to both of you. So, Nancy, talk to me.
Oh, Ellen. I don't know if I should yet.
There we go. It's time for the palate cleanser. Speaking of, we always do a palate cleanser, Gregory. It's not just for you, although this one is just for you, I have a feeling. Nancy.
You do? Well, mine doesn't have pumpkin in it.
I don't know. That's just what came to my mind.
Metaphorical. Mine actually leans more towards Leslie, in fact, being that the world is the way it is, or no surprise to anyone. Anyway, I investigated. There is such a thing, Leslie probably knows about this, there is such a thing as laughter yoga. And no, it was not invented.
She's laughing right now. You can laugh, Leslie.
It's been around. but the setup, it's just like yoga. There's stretching, there's chanting, there's breathing, there's, of course, preparing the lungs for laughing. It's like 30 to 45 minutes of acting and visualization, but... according to it, listen to these benefits. There's, you improve your cardiovascular, you reduce stress and anxiety, you lower blood pressure, you enhance your creativity, your productivity. It promotes positive thinking because, you know, you can't overthink and or think when you're laughing at the same time. Mm. And, of course, the best part is it's totally low carb, right? Anyway,
yes.
I don't know if there's a 2-drink minimum on laughter yoga, but it's out there, and you can find a class, no doubt. I have no doubt. Probably even in Charlottesville.
Thank you. We are all laughing here, actually. Leslie's trying not to laugh on the mic, but you can totally laugh.
I'm putting my hand on my chest.
Heard of it.
So loud. You can laugh. My palate cleanser is that in the United Kingdom, ketchup was historically made with mushrooms. Did you know this? As a primary ingredient.
Of course not.
Wow, Nancy. I said that you were like passionately a good friend of mine, and now you're making fun of me. No, I'd like to be teased.
I'm making fun of myself.
Oh, okay. That's like the history of ketchup, I believe. And eventually tomatoes were used because it tasted so good. But it started out with mushrooms. Let's all look into that. I know, it's like, everyone's like, really? I feel like no one is believing me.
I have no reason to doubt you.
My insecurities are coming out. Okay.
I am going to research
that. Anyhow, also, I wanted to mention that we're going to have a super moon, wolf moon, blood moon this Sunday, which means it's a total lunar eclipse. It's going to be viewable on the East Coast around 10:43 or 10:53. So I don't know if y'all knew about that. Yeah,
I have plans. Looking at Mars at that time. No, that sounds very cool, Ellen. That sounds very cool.
We're doing laughter therapy right now as I rifle through my notes. You know what I also wanted to mention is that next week who we have on the docket. Tracy Howe, who's just back from Tijuana, where she joined a delegation going to help with legal and humanitarian aid. So she's also a musician, activist, and founder of Restoration Village Arts. Charlottesville, and Angela Chalfie, a champion for the rights of the indigent. She is now the executive director of the Legal Aid Justice Center, serving low-income Virginians. So we'll talk to them next week. Nance?
What do you think? I'm still thinking about ketchup.
Are you?
I am. The magic of mushrooms.
And with that, I want to thank everyone, our guests, Gregory Lewis, Leslie Hubbard, Nancy Lawrence, especially, every week sits through this with me. And our music is by Springtide. And just remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.